4 minutes after 8 o'clock. Welcome to the Morning Magazine for Friday, August 5th of 2022. I am your host, Rosanna Longobetter. Thank you for joining us on listener-supported community radio, coming up after headlines. It is the first Friday of the month, so that means Natural Almanac is coming your way this morning. An update on the ACLU's lawsuit against Boulder's urban campaign ban. And then we hear about how communities on the Western Slope are turning trash into what they call black gold. And finally, we will get to this week's episode of Sports Talk to finish up our show. At 8:30, Connections comes your way. Host Kathy Partridge speaks about nuclear resistance on the eve of the Hiroshima bombing anniversary. Guests Jack Joppa Cohen, award-winning publisher of nuclear resistance for over 40 years and veteran of Boulder Base Close Rocky Flats nuclear weapons, is the guest. He is part of the movement in the 70s and the 80s. And also, leaders from the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center will join her. And then at 9:30 a.m., we will bring you 2.5 hours of eclectic music your way with our sound morning sound alternative. And that's all still ahead. But first, we have headlines with KGNU's Kiara DiMari, who recently got accepted into the Next Generation program at NPR. Congrats!
The federal government officially announced monkeypox as a public health emergency yesterday. Governor Jared Polis said Colorado will increase vaccine clinics, expand testing, and treatments. According to the press release, Colorado has been responding to monkeypox with a full response, which includes testing at the state laboratory and hosting clinics to administer the limited vaccine supply from the federal government since mid-May. The state has a data dashboard that updates at 10 a.m. Tuesday through Friday, and as of August 4th, Colorado has 79 cases. People who have symptoms of monkeypox, such as fever, headache, muscle and back aches, swollen lymph nodes, chills, exhaustion, and respiratory symptoms, or people who think they have been exposed to monkeypox, should contact a healthcare provider to discuss testing. Fire crews responded to a house fire at 1033 5th Street around 8 p.m. Thursday. Boulder Fire and Rescue were able to contain the fire to one structure with no injuries. Boulder Fire Rescue spokeswoman Maria Washburn told the Daily Camera that residents may see and smell smoke for some time and crews will remain on scene. Former Boulder swim coach has been charged with 3 counts of sexual assault on children. John Michael Beber coached the Boulder Swimming Club team from 1997 to 2002. The Daily Camera said, according to a witness who was with Colorado Swimming at the time, Colorado Swimming received only rumor and speculation, and no formal complaints were filed. The witness said parents decided not to take further action after Beber resigned from the team in 2002 when confronted with the allegations. A third witness came forward and said that she would regularly visit Beber's apartment while she was 16 and 17, and her teammates told police they too confirmed at the time they were in a relationship. USA Swimming was the subject of multiple lawsuits in 2020 in California that alleged the organization of not protecting their swimmers against assault. Beber is free on a $30,000 bond and has a preliminary hearing October 10th. Boulder City Council passes a new guide to guide the parks and recreation for the next couple of years. KGNU's Luis Lacone has more.
Boulder City Council voted to change and update the 2014 Park and Recreation Department's master plan Thursday. The new plan designates parks and recreation staff to support low-income areas, older adults, and those with disabilities. Thursday meeting staff said that they would need about $5 million more to properly staff the department, maintain community spaces, and keep pace with the community expectations. Recognizing our critical role in promoting community health and well-being, this master plan includes policy guidance that will help us ensure that Boulder's tax investments in parks and recreation are optimized for the community benefit, said the senior manager Regina Elser, according to the Daily Camera. Only the Parks and Recreation Department gets about $29 million in funding, according to the department's report. The master plan will identify new sources of funding, with one of them being philanthropy to fund the department. For KGNU, I am Luis Licon.
After weeks of fighting and getting arrested, Mesa County Clerk Tina Peters finally got the recount for the Republican Secretary of State that she was hoping for on Thursday. Peters lost to her opponent, Pam Anderson, by 88,578 votes. In order for there to have been a recount, Peters had to come up with $255,000, which she largely gathered from out-of-state donors after appearing on a webcast by the former President Donald Trump's old advisor, Steve Bannon. According to 9 News, she received around 5,000 donations. And even though Peters is still the Mesa County clerk, she cannot contact her office or report to work due to felony charges related to a security breach. Today is expected to be cloudy across the Front Range. In Fort Collins, there's a high of 97 and a low of 61. In Denver, a high of 98 and a low of 70. And in Boulder, there's a high of 95 and a low of 65. For KGNU, I'm Kiara Damari.
We go now to Nature Almanac.
It's August. What's happening in the natural world? Here are Boulder naturalists Ruth Carroll Cushman and Scott Siebers.
We've come up to the foothills west of Lyons to experience the peak of migration for hummingbirds. And here we're being hosted graciously by Davis to see his wonderful hummingbird feeder setup.
I have a whole bunch of feeders and they're all on pulleys because of bears, including two cubs and a mama. Anyhow, and so they like to climb whatever I have and knock the feeders down and eat them.
The broadtail male whistles when he flies, and I believe it's a wing feather.
And that's what makes that noise.
The rufous and the calliope and the black-chinned hummingbirds, also the males, have wings that make different trills, Rufus being the buzziest.
The deepest one,
I think. Yeah.
Davis has so many feeders set up here. How many do you have, Davis?
Not that many, just 4 hummingbird feeders and a couple of suets, a thistle and a sunflower, and then water. Water's a good attractor for birds. Hummingbirds is just strictly sugar water. It's not rocket science. You don't need to put food coloring in it or anything because they're going to come to whatever's reddish, and most feeders have a bunch of red on them. They eat plenty of other things, nectar and flowers. They're pollinators. I don't know about the other hummingbirds, but our local breeders, the broadtails, when the female's feeding chicks on the nest, they feed them about 90% insects. So they'll go out over a stream where they're nesting and pick off a mosquito and bring it back and stuff it down the kid. A calliope is the smallest bird in North America. They're quite as big as my thumb, but I'm big. I don't know what they weigh. They might weigh probably about as much as a pencil. And it has a gorget, which is the bright chin that a lot of hummingbirds have. Both they and the rufous breed north of Colorado. And then they come through here in July and August, and so that's what we're seeing now.
I think my favorite of the hummingbirds is the rufous hummingbird, and we're seeing several males. They have a brilliant gold-red gorget, and then they also have rufous coloring on the back. Very, very pugnacious. So there's plenty of nectar for all of them without fighting, but fighting must be in their blood, particularly the rufous. We call it sometimes the red baron because it's so pugnacious.
They're infamous for finding a feeder and guarding it, using more energy than they can actually drink in a day just to keep other birds from drinking on it. The rufous hummingbird, very interesting migration pattern. Most birds, you know, fly somewhere and then they fly back, basically the same route. Rufous hummingbirds migrate up the coast of California in the spring, so we never see them in the spring, and then they migrate back south down the mountains, and so we get them in the fall, and California never sees them in the fall. That's fairly unique among migrant birds.
The rufous and the calliope are migrating through, timed with our annual monsoon rains, usually starting in early July and lasting through September. That creates a flush of
are native wildflowers, especially Monarda and Scarlet Gelia, and those are favorite natural foods for the hummingbirds to forage on as they're heading south. It's a perfectly timed cycle for hummingbird migration.
Ruth Carol Cushman and Scott Sievers are friends and Boulder naturalists.
Colorado's American Civil Liberties Union is continuing to fight Boulder over what is known as the city's camping ban. The ban, which Boulder City Council approved for close to $3 million in April of 2021, criminalizes camping with the use of a tent or sleeping outside with the use of a blanket on public property in Boulder. Despite police reportedly clearing 389 urban camping sites and making dozens of arrests, Boulder homelessness has surged in the past year. Last week, the ACLU defended a complaint they filed in May saying Boulder's camping ban violates people's constitutional rights. KGNU's Alexis Kenyon spoke with Annie Kurtz, an Equal Justice Works Fellow at the ACLU of Colorado, about the lawsuit and how Boulder is defending its camping ban.
So to start, Annie, will you tell us about Boulder City Attorney's motion to dismiss the original ACLU complaint against the camping ban? What was their argument?
Sure. So they sought to dismiss each of the claims that we raised in the lawsuit. And essentially, they're arguing that the facts that we've alleged don't state a constitutional violation. So they are not disagreeing with the facts that we've alleged in the complaint necessarily. They're just saying that even given everything we said, they don't think they've done anything wrong.
What are those facts that you've alleged and they say are not a violation of constitutional rights?
Sure. So the basic idea is that Boulder doesn't have enough shelter for its population of people experiencing houselessness. And they know that, right? They've cut the available shelter basically in half. And yet, despite that, they are still enforcing these criminal ordinances that punish people for self-sheltering in public space, which is really the only option folks have been left with. And we're saying that that violates the Constitution for a number of reasons.
So Boulder's city attorney's office is saying, maybe you're right, people don't have anywhere to go, but it's not unconstitutional to tell them they can't use a blanket or a tent when they sleep on the street.
Yeah, that's basically what they're saying. There is no quibbling with the facts. They don't try to say a single time in their motion that people do have a place to go. They're just saying, essentially, this isn't on them and they shouldn't be held responsible for criminal enforcement.
And what do you say?
Well, they get the law wrong, really, across their motion. So we have three claims. One of them is based on the Constitution's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishments. And the principle there is that you can't punish someone for sleeping outdoors based on the false premise that they had a choice in the matter. Boulder tries to distinguish its ordinance from ones that other courts have found unconstitutional. And they're saying, we're not punishing people for being unhoused. We're punishing people for camping, right? And on that, I think every point they make is pretty unavailing. The second claim is that the city's prohibition on using items people rely on for their survival exposes them to real danger, right? People die outside in Boulder when they can't protect themselves from the elements. And we're saying the city knows that, and they can't constitutionally enforce these laws when they're putting people's lives at risk. And as to the exposure to danger, really, the city is just quibbling with the legal standard and what is required to prove endangerment under that standard. And I just think that they're wrong, and the facts kind of speak for themselves here. So, you know, I guess I'll say that I think understanding the law wouldn't really necessarily help you understand what the city's arguments are here.
So, but there have been developments recently, including a recent report from the Police Oversight Committee that found that despite Boulder's attempt to, in some ways, criminalize homelessness with the camping ban, since 2021, when they started enforcing the camping ban, Boulder's homelessness rates have significantly increased. There was also another study recently on Boulder's district attorney's office, which found that not only are people of color and people who are not housed much more likely to be arrested in Boulder, they're much more likely to face larger and harsher penalties. I mean, do you think either of these reports will affect the city's feelings about criminalizing homelessness?
Well, I certainly hope so. Right? I mean, our policing should be evidence-based. So there's no expert that will tell you that treating people like criminals is a way to address homelessness. And if this is really about addressing homelessness in Boulder, ultimately the question is, where are folks supposed to go, right? And the data shows that it's pretty clear it's time for the city to try something new.
I mean, it seems like people in Boulder are aware that housing prices are high, and people are also very much aware that homelessness in Boulder is a problem and that the number of unhoused people is growing. Is the city beginning to connect these dots, or what do you think?
I mean, I think that frustration explains part of why we felt we had to bring this lawsuit. Right? Because we've been having the conversations and the city wasn't acting. So, you know, we felt we had to take a bit more of a forceful approach and say, look, not only is what you're doing terrible policy and immoral, but it violates the Colorado Constitution and it has to stop.
So what are the next steps for this lawsuit? You filed your complaint, the city asked to dismiss it. What happens now?
So now the city will have an opportunity to reply to our response. And the city's reply is due at the end of this week. And the court is deciding whether to agree with the city that even if we had a trial and we proved all the facts that we alleged in the complaint, we wouldn't prove that the city has violated the Constitution. Or they can agree with us that if we do prove all the facts, we will have shown that the city is violating the Constitution. And if the court denies the city's motion, then the case will proceed to discovery of getting this to trial.
Well, Annie, is there anything I missed or you want to add?
Just that, you know, at any point, the city has the opportunity certainly available to it to just stop enforcing these laws, right? It doesn't have to take a judge's order for the city to do the right and the lawful thing here.
Annie Kurtz is an Equal Justice Works Fellow at the ACLU of Colorado. Annie, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you. Have an excellent rest of your day.
For KGNU, I'm Alexis Kenyon.
With an estimated 170,000 tons of organic material ending up in the Western Slope dumps, communities are looking for other options for this waste. Nutrient-rich composting material, often referred as black gold, is being created in the Drive Adobe Hills at a commercial composting site near the base of the Grand Mesa in Delta County. For KVNF and Rocky Mountain Community Radio, Lisa Young reports.
Carbondale-based company CHT Resources, which stands for Collection, Hauling, and Transfer, continues to improve its commercial composting operations near Adobe Buttes Landfill in Delta County. The 240-acre site operates under a certificate of designation from the Colorado Department of Health and Environment for roughly 80 acres. CHT also worked closely with Delta County prior to the adoption of its land use code. I asked CEO Erica Sparhawk what it was like working with the county on the current 14-acre project.
Oh, they were fantastic. We're one of the only certificates of designation they have. You know, it's not a process that they go through regularly like other approvals. And I was super impressed with the level of diligence and thoroughness that their staff provided. They were really great to communicate with. And then we had to go in front of the Planning and Zoning Commission, the county commissioners, and we got unanimous support from both of those entities.
An early morning tour of the facility yielded a wealth of information about the process of turning septic waste, biosolids, food waste, and yard waste into rich compost.
These piles need to cure for 90 days. And generally, that just as the temperatures come down, they're kind of going through their final stages of composting, and then, you know, to be a more stable product. And then once it's finished after that 90-day cure, then we test it, make sure it's safe for metals and for fecal coliform, because we are, you know, using the biosolids in there.
Jake DeWolf, co-owner and day-to-day operations manager, commented on the use of biosolids in the composting process.
Turns out to be a great feedstock, and it's safe. And a guy that we look to on the Front Range, who has one of the biggest composting operations over there, kind of said it this way. It's like, that's the most tested feedstock we get. I mean, it's tested at the wastewater treatment plant. We get it. We test. And the research shows it's safe. Whether, you know, people want to put it on their veggie garden, that's fine. I think there's a ton of uses for a bio solid compost.
Commercial composting transforms organic materials into usable compost while diverting waste and extending the lifetime of area land fills. Large-scale composting also reduces methane emissions known to cause climate warming. Organic materials are the largest waste stream being dumped into limited space in Colorado County and city land fills. That represents roughly 36% of reusable debris that could go into composting being buried beneath the surface. While much of the organic material at the Delta County site is locally provided, a well-known ski town in San Miguel County has chosen to truck its biosolid waste nearly 2 hours away to help CHT produce black gold.
The city of Telluride now brings their biosolids here, and that comes from a wastewater treatment plant. They were taking them to a landfill. Part of their community goals is to be more responsible with their waste and compost as much as they can. So they bring their waste here now.
It's estimated that up to 170,000 tons of organic material end up in Western Slope dumps. Composting is an environmentally responsible way to create a high-quality finished product that can be used on lawns, gardens, and fields, and serves as an example of a productive circular economic model for local communities. In an effort to keep usable waste out of the nearby landfill, CHT is currently collecting yard or green waste free of charge. They are also working to develop a new project to clean septic wastewater for irrigation.
Yeah, we dewater that septic. Basically, the midwater, you could call it, just would go down to be evaporated, and then we use the solids in the compost. We're actually refining that process a little with a dewater that we just got that will really kind of help clean up the midwater. It's not dischargeable standards, but where we can then irrigate with that.
Going forward, CHT will continue to grow their current feedstocks while looking for additional food waste from businesses, schools, correctional facilities, and hospitals willing to haul the organic waste to the site. For KVNF, I'm Lisa Young.
Now we're going to go to our sports talk segment. And we apologize for the glitch. We had to play again that Rocky Mountain Community Radio piece. Here we go.
Jimmy talk about any kind of sports. Local sports, professional sports, racing sports, all sports, big sports, small sports. Hello, KGNU listeners, and welcome to Sports Talk with Jimmy. I am your host, Jimmy Searfoss, coming at you with the biggest and best sports stories from across the Front Range, except for today. Today's story is an exception, and that is because today's topic deserves an exception. You see, on August 2nd, the sporting world lost a great man when the former Los Angeles Dodgers play-by-play announcer Vin Scully passed. The phrase greatest of all time is a term in sports that is used way too often these days, but there are cases when such a subjective term becomes objective, and that is the case for Vince Scully. You would be hard-pressed to find anyone in sports announcing that would not put him at the top of their list of all-time greats. He had an impeccable sense of detail. Through the radio alone, Scully could show you the game as if you were sitting and watching the game right next to him. And that was the goal. It would even become a saying that he would use where he would tell the audience to pull up a chair into the booth with him while he called the game. He had a cadence and voice to him that was soothing and relaxed while also knowing just when to toss in the right amount of excitement at the right time. It was a perfect personification of the game of baseball itself. When he started with the Dodgers back in 1950, they were still in Brooklyn, and they even had a player with the name of Jackie Robinson playing first base. He was just 22 years old when he found himself in the booth for the Dodgers. When the Dodgers made their move to Los Angeles, he moved with them, and he taught the city the game of baseball. And he began it with what became his signature phrase, "It's time for Dodger baseball." Over his 67-year career, he had called 25 World Series, 3 perfect games, 18 no-hitters, and was the voice for several of the most memorable sports moments, like the catch in the 1981 NFC title game and Kirk Gibson's walk-off home run of the 1988 World Series. He always seemed to know the right thing to say at the right time, but would never take away from a moment. When he called the home run that placed Hank Aaron above Babe Ruth on the all-time home run list, he energetically said, "It's a high drive to deep left center field, Buckner back to the fence, it's gone." Then sat back, got himself a glass of water, and drank it slowly to allow the sounds of the moment to tell its own story. Scully has been quoted to say, "I try to call the game as quickly as I possibly can, then shut up and let the crowd roar, because to me, the crowd is the most wonderful thing in the world when it's making noise." When he retired in 2016, he spoke directly to the fans on his last broadcast. He talked about his long friendship with the fan base and how in his heart he knew that he always needed them more than they needed him. Baseball lost its voice on Tuesday, but sports fans will never forget the words of Vin Scully. That has been all the time for us this morning. I've been your host, Jimmy Searfoss for KGNU. Have a great rest of your day, and be sure to tune in next time at this same time next week for more Sports Talk with Jimmy.
Support comes from Natural Grocers with over 40 stores in Colorado. Natural Grocers is committed to improving the health of humans, local communities, and the planet. More information at naturalgrocers.com.
And that's all the time we have for today's show. Special thanks to Chiara Di Mari, Luis Licon, Nature Almanac crew, Alexis Kenyon, Lisa Young, and Jimmy Searfoss Sanchez. Next, connections.
Talk.
Talk show.
Talk back.
Talk radio.
Talk your talk.
Walk your talk.
KGNU talk.
Call in.
Call in and talk.
Call in and connect.
Connections.
Friday mornings at 8:30 on KGNU.